Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition, bit of a surprise edition to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. And it's been a while, and it might even be the first one of the year, but it is another These Football Times stag do. Now, we'll introduce the author, although to be fair, as we were discussing before, he's a little bit like the Henry VIII of These Football Times, but we'll come to that in a second. First of all, we'll come to the two groomsmen for this edition. It'll be no surprise, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, another book stag do for this guest.
Another book stag do. It's very much Rolling Stones, penultimate world tour. Although, you know, we know we can sneak him. We can sneak him through the Spanish authorities. Well, all he needs to do is write a few books and we'll put someone else's name on them. Don't worry about it.
Oh, that's what we should do. Yeah, we should get him a suit.
All right, I've already thought of that. It's okay. Don't worry. We'll keep him going for years to come. But yeah, definitely kind of like the Rolling Stones, you know, next to last tour but one. I'd like to take on the role of Keith Richards and tune in for incoherent rambling at some point.
I'm sure if we probably cast our mind back to a couple more of these podcasts, I'm pretty sure he'll have said that this time it's the last time.
Oh, definitely. If you backtrack, you know, you go find out the full repertoire of them, and there will definitely be a reference of last time around at least once or twice in each podcast.
Excellent. Well, luckily he's back for another one, and then also we have another groomsman. Maybe I'm not sure if this is your first These Football Times book stag do's or not, Mr. Dave Boller. Dave, welcome to the stag do of stag do's.
Good evening. I'm looking forward to this before the tax authorities descend upon our waiting author.
And so what we'll do is we'll call him, it's Barry Tracker, who's the guest tonight. Actually, it's Mr. Gary Thacker. It's his new book, Dutch Masters, that covers, well, it covers the European Cup success in the early 70s. But as we get into this, it's a lot more than that. Gary, welcome to another stag do. Surely there's nowhere else for you to go with regards stag do.
This is my favourite type of stag do, buddy. So, yeah, delighted to be back on and talking about the book. I take on board what you guys said about another tour, but my last book is coming out next year, and that's it. Then I'm finished after that, and I've had to pray for someone, so I can't get the book whisperer into my ear. But yeah, it's been great talking about the book. It's coming out soon. But you know, my favourite football, non-Chelsea football club of all time.
Yeah, probably we won't talk about Chelsea. We'll give you a bit of time off from Chelsea. It can be all about Ajax tonight. Now, it's been a little while since we've done these, but that's okay. Normally, the first thing we do is give you an open mic, I don't know why I'm telling you, Gary, they've always been about you, but we give you an open mic and an open forum to sort of talk us through why this book, you know, what was the inspiration behind it? Why did you write it? What's it about? Why do you think it will interest people?
I guess, firstly, why the subject? Well, I've written the one about the Dutch national team. I only write about things that are like, clubs that are like, teams that are like. So, you know, I've done one on England, one on Chelsea, one on the Dutch national team. And I guess this sort of rounds out the Dutch football experience. The Ajax teams of the early 70s, 71, 72, 73 that won the successive European Cup, their football played into the 74 World Cup team of the Orange, the best team ever to win the World Cup. I'm moving quickly on before Stuart has a chance to argue with me. So yeah, I just sort of want to round it out, the sort of the Dutch club section that fed into the I suppose it's a prequel to the brilliant, a beautiful bridesmaid book, really. And it's, to my mind, this was the sort of the genesis of my falling in love with football as it should be played. Not football looking for a home. This is football how it should be played. And they were, as I said, the best club team I've ever seen in my life. And You know, that's going back a few bloody years as well. So yeah, this is why I wanted to write the book. So what I've done is, although the main focus of the book is those three triumphs, what I've done is sort of gone back a little bit of the history of Ajax, how they came about. Because the subtitle of the book is when Ajax's total vert ball conquered Europe. So I've gone back to, you know, what is total football? Where did it come from? Who invented it? And how did this team from the backwaters of North European football manage to develop this ethos and become not only the best team in Europe, but actually the best team in the world as well? They won the Intercontinental Trophy as well. And then sort of moving on from there to how it sort of fell apart in typical Dutch fashion. Just when everything's perfect, I turn the table over, because that's just what Dutch football's all about. So that's the basics, the rationale behind this book, and very brief sort of overview of what's involved.
I'll come to the other two guys in a second, but just for me personally, I love reading your books, Gary, and like I say, I always imagine when we're doing these, I always imagine the audio version. So I'll be reading away in bed and you're in my ear as I'm reading it. And it sounds, we've had this discussion, it sounds like you just laid next to me reading the book to me. But more importantly than that, the type of books I love are books that not only go behind a story. It's very easy to look at the story of those three European Cups, but it's the story behind that. But more importantly than that, the things that I love is when people either gain quotes, gain access, interview people who were there, people who lived it, people who were sort of a witness to that time, first-hand accounts. And I think it would be remiss of me quite so early on when we're setting our stall out as to why this is such a good book, to give you the opportunity to talk about just some of the names that you've interviewed in terms of contribution to this book.
Of all the books I've written, this is the one that carries the most celebrated contributors. You know, you should say you should never talk to your heroes, but I managed to get an interview with Ruud Krol. What a guy, what a fantastic guy. You know, he agreed to have me a chat for about a quarter of an hour, and three quarters of an hour later, we were still going. And wonderful guy, no subject off out of bounds. So a wonderful chat with Ruud Krol. Managed to get a very brief interview with Johnny Rep as well. Pierre Vermeulen, who played for Feyenoord and the Dutch national team. Pete Wildschut, who played in the 1978 World Cup. And Sonny Siloy, who played for Ajax across two spells for about a dozen years and is still now involved with their academy. Sort of journalists such as David Winner, who wrote Brilliant Orange. Ord Kok, who won the Dutch Sports Book of the Year award on two or three occasions. His latest book is a biography of Cruyff, which, if anybody's read My Turn, the Cruyff autobiography, this book is so much deeper, so much more intense. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book, and was wonderfully privileged that Ord Kok sent me a signed copy of the book. What a nice guy. So, yeah, I've been so forward. Another guy I spoke to was a guy called Menno Potter. Might not be as familiar to people. Not involved with Ajax, but really an Ajax aficionado. He works for a newspaper called Old Patel in the Netherlands, and really an Ajax, a font of all knowledge about Ajax, and had a great chat with him, or several chats with him. So I've been so fortunate, and I probably missed somebody out, and I apologise if I've missed them out, because they were all so brilliantly important. But you know, to have conversations, instead of people who were there, Johnny Rep, Ruud Krol, it's just stunning, you know. And when I was having the conversation with Ruud, because I did the one with Johnny Rep on sort of like on WhatsApp, text message sort of thing. But when you talk, I was talking to Ruud Krol, it's so difficult not to fall over your tongue.
Yeah, I can imagine. Dave, I'll come to you first. Obviously, when people are writing books about such illustrious football history or topics or emotive subjects, and certainly this Ajax side, you know, tend to bring that out in people, not just in Holland, but European football and worldwide people. It gives, to me, like I say, it's the sort of books I like, because it sort of gives credibility to the writing that's being done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought the build-up to getting to that team, sort of 66, 67, whatever it is, onwards, was really interesting. That, you know, the growth of Ajax as a club and the concept of total football, where it fitted into that club, where it fitted into Dutch football in general. I was reading through all the stuff about total football, and it's still one of those things that everybody thinks they know what it is, but there's something kind of weirdly nebulous about total football, because what actually is it? You know, how do you really define it? I mean, I remember that Ajax side when they were winning the European Cups. I was, 7, 8, 9. So I remember watching the European Cup final because that was one of the few games that actually got live on telly, and that was golden days of black and white television. So I was trying to come to terms with what it was that they were doing, and I mean, they were a team that just captured the imagination, I think, more than any other sort of club side around that kind of period, and there was just something magical. I mean, to the extent that I remember, I got my dad to I had my Sabutio kit, and of course, when you bought Sabutio, you got a team in blue and a team in red. So I got my dad to paint the team in red with a bit of white around them, so that we had the red stripe down the middle. Because that was what, you know, Ajax were. They were the glamorous team, and they were doing something different. And I mean, yeah, as I say, I was 7, 8, 9. They were doing something different. I couldn't quite work out what it was that they were doing that was different. But there was something, I don't know, it's intangible about that whole total football. And I'm now going to force Gary to define total football completely for us, because I'm still not any of the wiser, really.
Yeah, come on, Gary. What you could actually do is just literally set the entire internet, the world, the Dutch, and everybody else in between. You could set everyone straight with the ultimate definition of total. Because part one, it is the very first question in your book.
Yeah, the reason why is it sets the scene for, and it's interesting to what Dave said about, you know, they were doing something different, nobody knew why or nobody knew how. And it's a great line David Winnicott has got in his book in Brilliant Orange, and I can't remember the exact phrase, so forgive me, David, but something along the lines of, they were like beings from another planet, somewhere with a superior football culture. And that's what they were. They were. But total football, I posed a question to 6 or 7 people, and also look back at what other people describe it as, like Cruyff describes it as, and they were all slightly different. And it's a bit, I use a phrase, it's a bit like fog. You can see fog in front of you, but if you try to grab hold of it, it's gone. It's gone. You can't. And the a definition of total football is very much like that. It's more of an understanding. It's more of an appreciation. It's more of a culture than you know. There's not 4-4-2 or 4-3-3 or a long ball or a short ball, or, you know, people say it's about changing position. And it is. It's about pressing. It is. And it's about playing offside. And it is. Into having great players, and it is, and it's all that, but it's 17,000 times more things as well. And the I had that sort of question with it. You know, it's an answer, because it's impossible to answer the question. It's a bit like, you know, searching for, I think he used the phrase, a bit like searching for Atlantis, or trying to define dark matter, or, you know, the Alchemist's Stone. I mean, these things, you know what they are, you know, they're there, but you try to explain it. A few podcasts ago, it might have been, Stu, on the, we did the Beautiful Bridesmaids pod, and I think you asked me what total football was, and I fell off my own feet over it, and I mentioned it in the book, that, you know, you blurt out 2 or 3 concepts, and then you think, you know, this, I ain't doing this justice, because it's impossible, because it's so many things. As I say, you know, there's, I quote quite a few of the guys who played in that team, and I think Nichols as well. And I asked people like Sonny Saloy, I asked Peter Vermeulen, I asked David Winner, I asked Earl Cock, I asked Benoit Pot, I asked Ruud Krol what it was, and all the answers were slightly different, but none of them were wrong. It's really a really strange thing.
I mean, the good thing is, I'm now going to ask Stephen Scragg. So I know you've asked the people who played it and the players who lived it and all of those things, but the question is, did you ask Stephen Scragg? But actually, Stephen, I'm going to ask you as a slightly different question. So you've had a little bit of time to warm up to the podcast. Now, what I'm going to ask you is, so we've decided it's quite difficult to fully define total football. So my question to you is, do you think it can be an entity that means different things to different people? Now, while I was thinking of that question a minute ago, I was trying to think of an analogy. And the only analogy I could come up with was God. So God can mean so many different things to different people. So my question is, do you think total football can be the same?
Total football can't possibly be one thing. It's everything that everyone wants it to be. You know, it's the Easter Bunny. It's Father Brilliant. Christmas. It's everything and anything. You know, it's the best band in the world. But the best band in the world to everyone is a completely different band from a completely different genre. So, you know, it's just one of those concepts that is everything that you want it to be. You know, Gary's right, you know, it's formations, it's compressing the play, it's, you know, the switching of positions, you know, it's everything that we've been told a million times at Total Football is. It's all of those things, but it's a million other things as well, you know, and many of them are intangible, but it's all steeped in simplicity as well. That's the great thing about it. And I think, though, the greatest kind of like football that you watch tends to be, you see them do wonderful things and they just seem so simple as well. It's just, you know, football, you know, like the Shankly phrase is kind of, you know, about kind of like the simplicity of football and people trying to overcomplicate it and stuff like that. And it really is, you know, a simple game. You know, the very best football teams play it so simply. You know, it's unreal how, you know, it's mastering the just the, you know, doing the simple things well. You know, but you know, within that, you know, back to the original question, the answer, yeah, it's all of those things and so many more. But predominantly, it's the Easter Bunny.
Okay, well, there we go. Should you ever write another, the trilogy of books about Dutch football, Gary, you can just call it Dutch Football, the Easter Bunny, or you call it whatever you want, but there you go. Just, we'll get into the book. I just have one more question for you, Gary, and then we'll get into the book and the structure and what you've covered and why you've covered and those sort of things, what the guys think about the, you know, the different parts. But my question, I like to ask this question a lot, especially when people, like you say, when you've written something that you either love or care about or have a vested interest in. Did you, and this probably equates to the beautiful Bridesmaids as well, did you ever feel either under pressure or, not concerned is probably the wrong word, I'll probably not phrase that correctly, but when you are writing about something that is so loved by millions and millions of people, did you feel any pressure to get it right? Did you feel any, do you feel a sense of responsibility to tell the story, to... Yeah, to tell the story and do it justice.
Yeah, I guess the short answer is yes, and very much the case with The Beautiful Bridesmaids as well, because there's so much depth to these things that you can't cover in a book. You know, I mean, when you're talking about three European triumphs, how it started and then how it finished and what it meant, the legacy of the game, and very much the same with the Dutch Master, sorry, The Beautiful Bridesmaids as well. You know, 120,000 words, it ain't enough. It ain't enough. And you can't go into the depth that you want to do and you need to, that you should do. I guess yeah, it's a good question, Stuart. I think the answer is yes, and you do. And I've had a couple of people on Twitter saying, you know, I'm looking forward to the book, and which is great, it's wonderful to read. And my answer tends to be, I hope I've done the story justice, because it's one of those things. And there's so many stories in football. It's one of these sports where, you know, you can find 20,000 stories, but this is a team that was, even now, I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote the book is it's coming out on the 50th anniversary of the third final, the third success. And even now, 50 years later, that team is still regarded as epic. Almost, it's almost legendary, mythical status it has. So you want to do the story justice, and I hope I have, but it's a damn good question still. I think you're absolutely right. I did feel under pressure to get it right. I hope I've come somewhere near.
I think you've come near. It just pleases me that you felt under pressure. I don't know, in a perverse way. Yeah, that's okay. I'm just kind of pleased that you did feel that pressure. Which is great. Dave, quick question for you again. And you know, before we sort of get into this book, but this side, and we might touch on. Well, we will touch on Bayern Munich, because I want to ask questions a bit later on about Bayern Munich and what happened subsequently. But there are some sides that just, as Gary's mentioned there, they're almost ethereal. They sort of transcend time, transcend, you know, I always like the phrase of being a fan of football. And fans of football love this Dutch, this Ajax side. Do you think there are many through the history of football is massive. I'm aware of this question. But do you think there are many sides in the game or in the history of game that focus attention like this Ajax side do, certainly club sides?
I think that's the point, isn't it? I mean, there are a few international teams that you can think of. I mean, Hungary 53, Brazil 82, obviously. It tends to be, it's easier to think of national teams, I guess, because of the World Cup and the impact of the World Cup, and that focuses them on. In club terms, it's very rare for a team to be as loved as this Ajax team is, I think. Bayern Munich, as you say, came and did the same thing straight after. And I think that was a fabulous team. But you don't feel warm about Bayern Munich somehow. For all the great players that they had, you don't feel that same sense of warmth. I mean, I think you're probably looking AC Milan, that team they had. I think maybe the Barcelona team, Guardiola's Barcelona team, that little period, was it 2008, 9, 10, whatever it was. It's very difficult to think of any others that have got that same. I know they transcend everything, don't they, somehow? And as Stephen, I'm sure, will come to point out, that kit works better than anybody else's, really. So, yeah, they've got a head start before you begin.
I've got a really another difficult question for Stephen. Clearly, this is the order that when we have an order that we go in, usually the third person gets the worst questions. My next question for you, Stephen, is what is it? What are the ingredients that have these side that these sides have? You know, Dave just mentioned the international ones, but if we stick with the club ones that Dave just mentioned there, what are the ingredients that makes a team transcend football? You've got a couple of minutes.
Again, it's a concoction of many, many things. Confidence at the heart of it, you know, within themselves, within each other, you know, just loving the ball. I think you know, you can't produce something of such great beauty if you fear the ball. A lot of players, a lot of teams fear the ball. You know, you get teams that are just happy to let the opposition have the ball for 80% of the time. You know, and you know, the best football is played by teams that have the ball, you know, and have it for, you know, as long as they want it, basically. But there's a lot of things that need to fall into place. You know, at the end of the day, dressing rooms are workplaces. You know, it's relationships between players, coaches. You know, you can throw in, you know, feuds in there. You know, the players that will be at each other's throats in the dressing room, on the training ground, and then they'll go out there on the pitch and they'll be together as a collective. It's having that defined, you know, essence of being able to say, there's the touchline, and once you walk over it, then, you know, we are harmonious. You know, it can be dysfunctional as you like off the pitch. You know, back, once you're back in that dressing room, you know, players who won't talk to each other for years and, you know, can't abide one another. But when they're on the pitch, they just click. It's you know, intangible. Much of it's intangible. There's tangible parts of it. There's the intangibles. But yeah, it's just a domino effect in a way.
The other thing I would add to that, though, it's partly what you're saying there, Steve. It's a vulnerability as well, and that's I think why you look at Ajax and you think, well, this is all great and it's very clever, and this could all collapse any minute now. And you never feel like that about that Bayern Munich team. Because that was a machine. I mean, they were great players and a great team and all of that, but they were a machine and they were just going to mow everything down at that point. And Ajax, for all that they were getting the same sort of results and doing fantastic things and playing this incredible football, it was kind of, I don't know, it was like Marilyn Monroe. You think this is all going to fall apart in a minute and be a disaster. And that's, I think, again, that's another reason why people warm to that team in particular.
What you get with a Bayern Munich, though, is they get to a defined plateau. Mm. But whereas you look at an Ajax at that point in time, there was no plateau. You know, the stars were the limit. You know, they could do whatever they want. You know, the if you plotted Bayern Munich and Ajax alongside one another on a graph, Ajax would be all over the place. It would shoot up, it would drop back down again, it would creep back up, and then it would go stratospheric again. Bayern Munich have just gradually go up, and then just be a high flat line, but it would never quite reach that those peaks that Ajax reached.
That's a great analogy. I do like that. So are we saying vulnerability then is a key ingredient for these teams? There needs to be an element of vulnerability
for the most beautiful ones, definitely. You know, for the ones that are metronomic, as you know, using Bayern Munich as an example, yes, you know, they don't have that vulnerability until they just kind of like fall apart as a, you know, as a generation, and then they're replaced by the next generation. You know, Ajax, you know, had that, you know, that vulnerability, you know, that potential for the self-destruct button. Bayern Munich never had a self-destruct button. You know, they created what they create. They created their bandwagon and didn't fit a self-destruct button. You know, it came without one. As far as they were concerned, it was an optional extra, and well, let's not have it.
Brilliant.
I got a contribution from Steve in the book, and I asked him about legacy, and he got a wonderful phrase at the end, just captures what he said there, is, as he at the end of the day, the only team that could destroy Ajax was Ajax, which sort of neatly captures what he just described. And he's absolutely right. I thought he captured that brilliantly.
You know, yeah, within that, that's a rare element in football, is, you know, Brazil 82, you know, a perfect example of that. You know, if we're talking individuals, George Best, you know, Diego Maradona, capable of such beauty, yet that vulnerability that Dave speaks of.
Excellent. Well, I feel like we've answered a lot of the universe's difficult questions in the first 25 minutes. Well done, guys. Great work on a Friday night. Well, some slightly easier ones now, Gary, to begin with. Certainly one of my most favourite parts of the book is that beginning of the Ajax story and how, you know, you sort of advocate this, you know, going back to Total Football, but Total Football was in existence long before the Dutch, sort of the Dutch version of it arrived. You know, there are versions of it. It can be found through earlier parts in the game. You talk about the English connection with Ajax and the influence and how esteemed, you know, some of the English coaches are, that, you know, in the early Ajax days. And to me, it's, you know, it doesn't just jump straight into 1969. You know, we have all this context, all this backstory, all this getting there to the main, you know, sort of to the main event. Was that always going to be in it? Did you feel like it was important?
Yeah, it was. Well, once I'd spoken to Menno particularly, who was wonderful about the history of Jack Reynolds at Ajax, who was coach there for, I think, about 20-odd years, and the major influence on Ajax. Interesting little story about their kit. Ajax originally wore red and white stripes and black shorts, and they got promoted under an Irish guy called Jack Kerwin, I think is what I'm right, about 1905, something like that, to the top division. But Sparta Rotterdam were also wearing the same strip. And obviously this is the day before you had, you know, second and third kits and away kits and all this sort of cobblers. So Ajax were faced with the situation of either turning down promotion or changing the kits. So what they did, they wanted to sacrifice the stripes. So they basically pushed all the stripes together to produce the broad stripe around down the middle of the shirt. That's how the iconic Ajax kit came about. And interestingly, within a 12-month period, at the same time, the Dutch national team used to wear all white with a red, white and blue sash across, representing the Dutch flag. And they played England. It was within months of Ajax getting promoted. And because England wore white as well, they had to change the kit. So they wore orange shirt because of the Royal Dutch House of Orange. And they lost 12-2 to England, and it remains their biggest defeat in international football. But they stuck with the orange shirt after that. So both the Ajax shirts and the iconic Dutch shirts were born within months of each other in the early 1900s. I found that absolutely fascinating when Menno mentioned that to me. But yeah, so going through a lot of, and these English coaches to talk about now aren't the people who, yeah, English coaches were employed because of the success of English football. However, the coaches the continental teams applied, and this wasn't just in Netherlands, but in France, Switzerland, Hungary, Austria, Germany as well, Italy as well, and Spain. They were the outliers. They were the non-conformists. They were the people who, the famous one is Jimmy Hogan, I should say, who went to the Netherlands and with his Scottish school of football, this short passing, control and possession brand of football. He didn't like the idea of the English traditional way of boot the ball at the park and chase it, and the biggest, strongest guy will get up front and he'll score the goals. And I mean, you know, some of that sort of balderdash still persists to this day, but there you go. But Jimmy Hogan, I should say, he took that to Holland. He worked at a small club called Dordrecht in Holland first, and then set the seeds there, and he moved on. He worked with Weissel, the Austrian wonder team, and they played a system called the Austrian Whirl, which was it players interchange positions. I think it was in the 30s. He then worked with Sebesh at on the Hungary, the Magical Magyars team, where, you know, the Hidiguti was the withdrawn centre forward, the false nine. You know, any sort of people who think that that false nine concept was invented by Pep Guardiola, you know, sorry guys, no, only about 40, 50 years too late. So, but yeah, he was so, and Jack Reynolds became coach at manager at Ajax, and it was Jack Reynolds who invented the system of every team at Ajax, be from the first team down to the youth teams, all played the same system. And this is what Cruyff took to Barcelona, and that's ethos still exists in Barcelona to this day. And after Jack Reynolds, who was very well respected in Amsterdam, at the De Meer, the old Ajax stadium, they had a stand named after him. And when they moved to the A Arena, now called the Johan Cruyff Arena, there's as you go into the VIP section there, I've never been there, but you go through what's called the Jack Reynolds lobby, and there's a plaque there representing the respect they had for Jack Reynolds there, Uncle Jack, as they used to call him in Amsterdam. And then obviously we had the Vic Buckingham here, as a couple of sessions with Vic Buckingham being in Ajax. So yeah, English coaches, but not traditional English coaches, were a big factor in the development of Ajax and total football.
It's your turn for a question, Dave, and I'm going to ask you this one. I'm going to give Steve a break, but I'll come to Steve another one in a second. This is something that's fascinating, and obviously I get to chat with the guys on the podcast and the guests we've had, and there's some, you know, sort of dedicated, incredibly knowledgeable football people, and obviously you three are part of that. But what I can never get my head around is what I see as a perceived indifference amongst most football fans to some of those names that Gary's just mentioned, you know, the Jimmy Hogan, the Vic Buckingham, who I know Stephen has a lot of time for and speaks quite passionately about the man. You know, Jack Reynolds, to me, there seems to be a, not to very, you know, sort of like say to the sort of the more intelligent football fans or the well-read football fans, but there just seems to be this indifference to these people who, you know, as Gary's just mentioned there, you know, create these ideas sort of 30, 40, 50, 60 years before they become in vogue. And yet there seems to be very little recognition of those pioneers of this sort of game.
Because they're not on YouTube. That's the problem.
I like that.
I think that is part of the problem. If it's,
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
If it didn't happen on television, if it didn't happen on film, it didn't happen. And I think that's an increasing, you know, I think that becomes the prevailing thought, because obviously, you know, you don't go back that far. I think as well, myself and Gary in particular, would have grown up consuming a lot of football knowledge from annuals and books and stuff, because you didn't have, you know, the wall-to-wall coverage on Sky and BT and God knows what else. And a lot of the times it was from more considered journalists, perhaps, you know, the grew up with the likes of Brian Glanville and people like that, who were seeing that outside world a bit more than we were. I think also there's a degree of embarrassment in this country, because I mean all of these great movements in international football and world football, a lot of them stemmed from British coaches, English coaches, who we basically threw out the country for being a bloody nuisance, really, and having too many thoughts of their own, and being far too much for the chairman of various football clubs to put up with. So we banished them abroad, and then they came back and taught us the game that we're supposedly the owners of. So I think there's a bit of embarrassment, really, amongst all of that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a great, and that was a great part of the book, the growth of Ajax and the involvement of Jack Reynolds in particular. I mean, I know the Vic Buckingham stuff a bit, given that he's a former West Brom manager, so I know plenty about old Vic, but. No, I think it is a shame that people don't pick up on that wider story, because it's absolutely fascinating. Why did we turn our back on all of that kind of stuff? You know, why were we so insular? Why the hell didn't we go to the World Cup until 1950? I mean, that's another aspect of it, isn't it? You know, we had this one style of football, and that was kind of. I remember when I was doing a book about Danny Blanchflower, I spoke to a guy called Larry Canning, who used to be a broadcaster in the Midlands. Gary will probably remember him. He was at the Villa at the time when Danny Blanchflower was there. And he was complaining about the lack of intelligence in English football and our failure to pick any of it up. And he said, you know, after 1953, and we all went down to Wembley to watch the game, the Hungary game. And he said, "And what do you think was the one development that English football learned from the Hungarians?" I said, "I don't know, did we start to train better, or did we?" No, he said, "The only thing that came to English football after that was hooped socks. That was it." And I think that sums up about 50 years of English football already.
Stephen, like I say, you've been a passionate advocate, but certainly for Vic Buckingham, you know, obviously, you know, Dave's knowledge from there as well. But what, you know, and Gary's book does it brilliantly. And I don't mean when I say this by accident. It's you know, they are just part of this. They happen to be part of the story that Gary's book was about. But how do we, you know, Dave made a great point that it's not on YouTube. So, you know, how do we go about either bringing these names further to the forefront or making sure these names don't disappear, you know, in the midst of time as, you know, as generations come and go?
I think we're sadly getting to a point in time where, you know, there's no catching up on what's lost in a way. You know, it's going to take kind of, you know, the likes of us who are fascinated by that era and those individuals to dig down and find those, you know, the you know, if there's anyone around who's seen their teams play, basically, we've lost a generation of people. I know someone I know, Haider Jowad, you know, and he regrets now, you know, because he knew of people who played in the 20s and the 30s and stuff like that, and when he was younger, in his early 20s, and thinking, God, I wish I'd had, when I was talking to them for kind of like other reasons, that I wish I'd have asked them about those playing days and, you know, and know more about it, you know. And we're losing those people who will have experienced the teams that Vic Buckingham put out and people like that. So yeah, it's kind of going to rely on the likes of us to kind of like, you know, amplify, you know, make the noise for them. And people in the future, the rights of the future, to be able to do that as well. Because I think, luckily enough, you know, football writing's getting better and better. You know, it's a completely different thing to what it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You know, and I think a great deal of people, the way Gary kind of like explained it at the start, and that, you know, he just writes what he wants, and that's the great beauty of it. I think there's a lot of us, and there's a lot, you know, it's a growing band of people who just write what they want to write about, what they're passionate about, and if you've got that passion driven writing, you know, they're the people who strive to find that extra nugget of information about an individual, whether that's a manager, a player, or whatever it is, a team, an era. You know, they'll delve and dig as deeply as possible, as humanly possible.
I think it's a great, but I agree with Dave. I think it's a great part of the book. I loved it. I loved that whole context and scene setting for what was to come. The other thing, well, there was quite a few things that surprised me in the book, Gary. One also being, I mean, I knew of the late sort of development of professionalism in Dutch football, and when you put that into context from the professionalism of Dutch football to winning what is essentially the biggest trophy in European club football is ridiculously short period of time. What I also didn't realise was that Cruyff was actually Ajax's first professional player, and it still didn't pay enough that he had to go and find another job to sort of cover his costs. And yet, like I say, in what is a ridiculously short time span, you go from just one of your players being paid professionally and having to do part-time work to be in the best club side in Europe. It's just the most incredible story that gives further context, as Stephen put it, you know, when he used his graph analogy, that incredible steep, sharp rise, that development, that success was something that I hadn't put all the pieces together, I suppose, is probably the best way to put it, until the book brings it all into focus.
They had this sort of situation, I can't remember the exact phrase to use in the book, but it's something like that. It would run the club was like a part-time job. The directors, it was something to do on the weekend, go back to work and, you know, run their own business the week and run the club at the weekend. Very amateurish, and it's one of the things that Mikkels addressed when he got to the club, that, you know, if they wanted success, they had to pay the players better. And Cruyff, and as you mentioned, as the first professionals, Kaiser was the other one, and Kaiser had to run a tobacconist's to eke out his wages. And, you know, this wasn't unusual in Dutch football. Being professional was more in name than in sort of effect. And it wasn't until Mikkels basically went to the board and said, you know, we've won success, we've got to play players better because I want to train more, be more professional and encourage more players to come along. And that's what happened. A guy called Van Praag, I think his name, excuse me, I think he was the chairman at the time, had his successful music business, and he sort of found the funding, and they gradually built up from there. But as you say, the success came so quickly, and you know, people go on about, you know, the class of class of 96 or whatever it was, four or five players, brilliant, well done. You know, Ajax, they bought a whole raft of players from their youth team. I mean, we're talking of the team that won the European Cup in 71, Stoy, Serbia, Kral, Hulsoff, Hahn, Cruyff, Kaiser, Svart, Muren, all came through the Ajax youth system. So that was the system. They did buy players to go along, but that was the genesis of the team. So the crop of players, obviously, I mean, one outstanding crop of players. I mean, you know, having this sort of, okay, guys, we're going to play this new brand of football and you're going to be all magical and all this sort of thing. Well, that's great. And then, you know, you've got three players who could don't know which way to kick the ball. But they're all brilliant players and they all came through at the right time. And there was a sort of a nice run. I mean, Svart was sort of like the veteran when they came to the 70s. But there was younger players coming through like Kral and Hulsoff. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is a magical period of almost stellar improvement and success. Came from, you know, such a low base, amateur Dutch football in the early 60s, before, you know, or mid 60s, was borderline amateurish. And there's a line that David Winner has got in his book, Brilliant Orange, I think I quoted in the Beautiful Bridesmaids book, this: when the Dutch qualified for the 1974 World Cup, they had a World Cup qualifying record equal to that of Luxembourg. That's 1974. That's the year after Ajax's success. So that's how the rapid decline was. They played in two World Cups, 1934 and 1938, played one game in each of those and lost both times. And then you had this sort of crop of players come through it, not only to Ajax, but also at Feyenoord as well, but predominantly to Ajax. I mean, amazing story.
It is. Like I say, it's an incredible story. And again, we're going to go on something else that I am pleased that I'm leading this, by the way, because it allows you to ask all the questions that I love to ask. My next question for you, Dave, if you, and this is not an age-related question, I apologise if it comes across like that. But, yeah, you're right, it is. But, that's why, because when there's a but. When you think about the 60s and 70s, you think about Amsterdam, Holland, you know, and the freedom of thinking, freedom of expression, the social and cultural context of Holland and Amsterdam at that time. Do you think that played a part in the football team and how they represented their city, how they represented Dutch culture? Do you think that was the right team in the right country in the right era?
Well, that is a good question.
Thanks.
What you're basically saying is, did they win three European Cups while being stoned? That's basically
Well, it depends who's listening. If the lawyers are listening, no. If it's just the four of us on playback in our car, yeah.
I think, you know, great teams do reflect the culture of the country that they come from. So, I mean, there has to be an element to that. I think that the Dutch culture is a very... it's a very questioning one. They don't take anything for granted. They don't take anything as set in stone. All the Dutch players that I've interviewed, you know, at club level and whatever over the years, they're not always very popular in dressing rooms in this country, I've always found, because they actually think for themselves. And by and large, dressing rooms don't like people who think for themselves. I mean, you know, I remember interviewing Pierre Van Hooijdonk while he was on strike. I mean, he was as popular as a fart in a spacesuit at the time with his colleagues at Nottingham Forest. But that seems to me, the ones that I've met, that seems to be a Dutch mentality. And I think that then has to go onto the way that you play the game, and it has to go onto the pitch. I mean, as Gary was just saying, the speed with which it all happened is breathtaking in a way. I mean, you know, from absolutely nowhere up to only just turning professional to then being, you know, the club. You know, Ajax were in the 69 final. Feyenoord won the 70 final. And I, you know, I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, that speed. But I think something comes from that ability to think for yourself. And, you know, that goes back to, I suppose, to what we were saying earlier about vulnerability and all that kind of thing. It's that it's not a machine kind of football. It's a freedom of expression football. And I think that's just central to the Dutch psyche, the Dutch mentality. So I think in that sense, I don't know so much necessarily about the time. I mean, I think the time is perhaps coincidental, but in terms of it being a Dutch team that played that way, then yeah, that makes perfect sense.
The two coaches that were in charge of the club when they won the European trophies are very different, and Mikkels was quite a disciplinarian. And it's a sort of metaphor for what I'm talking about here. If you look at the 1971 final and the 1969 final, in fact, all the Dutch players have short hair, not much facial hair. In fact, I don't think even Ulshoff had a beard in 69 and 71. Move on to 1973, for example, the semi-final against Real Madrid, where Kovacs is a much more laid-back manager. All the players had facial hair, almost all of them, without exception, had long hair. And there's a wonderful comparison when they're playing Real Madrid. Real Madrid players are all very traditional, numbered 1 to 11, all with short hair. The Ajax team, very much bohemian in appearance, and four or five players wore numbers that weren't in 1 to 11. Obviously, Cruyff had 14. I think Blankenberg had 12. I think Hahn had 14, sorry, 15. I can't remember, four or five of the players weren't even numbered 1 to 11. They were the iconoclasts by that time, but that was very much more after Kovacs came in. Under Mikkels, the discipline was much more resolute.
For you, Steve, I just want to come back to it. And it's a great point that Dave made. And again, it's brought up in the book, but it's also something that I suppose I knew but didn't really put into context. And, you know, we talk about this Ajax side and obviously the impact of three European Cups in a row. And, you know, that hadn't been done since, you know, Real Madrid started the competition off with five. But actually, a Dutch side makes five finals in a row from sort of 69 to 73. And that almost is something that also, in my opinion, gets lost because of what Ajax go on to achieve in those three seasons.
It does. Feyenoord fall, you know, under the radar within so much of this. I mean, they also won the UEFA Cup in 74, you know, against Tottenham. You know, it's a incredible era. You know, there's a rise in PSV amid all this as well. You know, Twant in the mid 70s had a wonderful side. You know, this was a movement that, you know, Ajax, you know, inspired, you know, so much within themselves, but they inspired other teams to rise as well, and, you know, not necessarily in a copycat manner, but to come up with their own versions of an effective style of football that would, you know, challenge Ajax. Not just, you know, to challenge them domestically, but to go out there across Europe and succeed as well. So for Feyenoord to win that 1970 European Cup, you know, was an amazing thing. You know, and their style of football as well was different. You know, Rotterdam and Amsterdam, two polarizing, you know, polar opposites as far as City's concerned. You know, known people from Rotterdam who would always be of the mind that Rotterdam works while Amsterdam parties, you know. So, you know, very, very different, you know, and within this is what makes the Dutch national side so fragmented so much of the time, yet so utterly, utterly bewitching and talented at other times. But yeah, you know, Feyenoord, you know, they I suppose they go hand in hand with it. You know, you look at that Feyenoord side and it's a wonderful one. Ernst Happel, you know, no slouch himself. Cohen Mullion, you know, Royce hero, you know, as part of that side. You know, Theo van Duvenbode, you know, he departs Ajax after the 69 European Cup final, and goes and wins it with Feyenoord the following year. It's just this, as Dave said as well, this You know, the Dutch psyche is, you know, unless you've experienced it. I've worked with a Dutch lad, you know, for a good few years, and you know, he was exactly the same. You know, there's a certain, I don't know, almost a kind of, not an arrogance, but almost a, you know, just a kind of, almost a violent intent, almost a violent undercurrent, almost. It's the only way I can describe it. There's a sense of certainty, and you know, my way is the right way. And you know, if you argue the toss with them, then you're not going to get far. You know, you can either agree with them or disagree with them. There's no in between. There's no grey areas.
Feyenoord and Happel play a really important part in the development of Ajax. A few weeks before the European Cup final in 1970, Ajax were playing at the De Meer against Feyenoord. Ajax were, I think, 2 points clear at the top of the league. And at this time, Mikkels was still developing his team, and they were still playing. They were playing a 4-2-4, whereas Happel's was 4-3-3. And the total football was really struggling to work. He was having to drop forward back into the midfield sometimes to make it work. And Ajax were losing 3-1 with about 7 or 8 minutes to go. And basically, Happel's midfield had overrun the Ajax midfield. From this game, Mikkels decided that 4-2-4 was not going to work. Total football needed 4-3-3. And he went out at the end of the season and signed Johan Niskins to make the 4-3-3 work. But in that game, leading up to the European Cup, this was Happel's first season at Feyenoord. And when he went in there, there's the goalkeeper's got a guy called Eddie Peters Graflund, and he was the captain of the team. And Happel dropped him and bought Treutel in. I think he came from Telstar to play. Treutel played this game, and the last 7 or 8 minutes of the game, he made two mistakes. Ajax got a draw, which basically killed a Feyenoord's chance of winning the Eredivisie title. And Happel dropped him for the European Cup final, brought the veteran back, and they went and won the European Cup. But it was a real milestone game for both clubs, and it was the game that convinced Mikkels that the 4-3-3 was the way to play. You're going to play total football.
Right, guys, I'm going to ask two questions, and I'm going to ask the same questions to all three of you, okay? So be ready. Now, I'll give you a bit of thinking time in a second. So, Gary, you know, in your book, you know, like I said, the book's great. And to me, it's almost how we get to the three European Cups is the most interesting part for me. But so part one and part two is about total football and the English influence. Part two is those seasons from when Mikkels arrives, building up to these three European Cups. And then each campaign has its own part within the book. So the first question I'm going to ask all three of you, I'm not going to start with you on this one, Gary. I'm going to start with you first, Dave. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, which of the three campaigns, in your opinion, is the best campaign? Now, you can define that however you want. You can define it by results, style of football, the players who are on the pitch, the teams they beat. I don't mind how you define it. But in your opinions, of those three consecutive European Cup winning campaigns, which, in your opinions, is the best campaign? That's your first question, fellas. Dave, you can kick off. So you've got all three to choose from.
I think I would have to go for 1971, the first one. I mean, the first one's always the most important, I think, with any, whether it's your first league title or your first European Cup or whatever. Because they've been, although it's such a rapid rise for Dutch football to get to that point, for Ajax, it seemed to take them forever to get to win the European Cup. Because they were there, you know, I mean, what was it, 66, 67, when they beat Liverpool and, you know, sort of came of age as a European team. And they two or three campaigns after it. And then the bastards from down the road got there first. And then, so then the pressure is really on to go and, you know, emulate them. And I think at that point, teams can either crumble and fall apart, or they can really grab hold of it and say, right, we're not having this. And then go on. And that for me is what makes a great team. You know, I mean, we've talked, there's the decade series that we're going to do in the summer, and we've talked about a few of those. And it's teams that come and make that run, the last 15 games of the season, they win 13, draw the other two, and they come through and win the league title. And that, for me, there's always something really attractive about that, because that's a team that really means business. And that's a team that, when the moment's there, they'll grab hold of it and they'll throttle it to death and make the absolute most of it. When, yeah, having been the team in Dutch football and having won a bunch of league titles and being the ones that were, you know, they got to a European Cup final, they were the ones that were going to win it. If any Dutch team was going to, and then Feyenoord go and win it, then the pressure's on and then you have to go and win it the following year. So for me, that's the big one. Once you've won it once, it then becomes easier to win the other two.
That's a great rationale. I like your rationale for that.
I've just made it up. I don't know whether it's any true or not.
No, I like it. It's great. Like I say, this is why I throw these questions. I'm always interested in what people think and how they see things and their perspective of things. Stephen, for you, which do you think? You can pick the same one as Dave. I mean, obviously, if you pick the same reasons, that would be rubbish. But you can still pick it if you want.
I'm not going to pick 71. I'm not picking 71. I'm going for 72, 73. Because, you know, it's the brushing aside of Bayern Munich. It's the stylish beating of Real Madrid. It's Jerry Muren playing keepy uppy with the ball at the Bernabeu. You know, it's going into the Lions' den and saying, look, we've reinvented the wheel. You know, the wheel is no longer round. It's whatever shape we want it to be. And, you know, talking earlier on about kind of like Meikle's Ajax and they're being clean cut. No one's got a beard. They've all got short hair. You know, I want them to have beards. I want them to have long hair. You know, 1970-71 is a hard day's night. You know, by the time you get to 72, 73, it's let it be. This is where they are on the rooftop of Apple, just doing their own thing. The police are closing in. You know, the cameras are there. They're just everything's just rolling. Billy Preston's, you know, at the side there and, you know, helping them out a little bit. And, you know, it's got added Johnny Rep. They win it back, you know. They win it in Zagreb. They even go, you know, behind the, you know, they go to the Eastern Bloc to go and do it. You know, it's 72, 73 for me.
Which one's the magical mystery to you?
Now, Gary, in an ideal world, and it's your book, obviously, so you can choose what you want. But in an ideal world, you'll pick 71, 72, and have a completely separate reason for that. But please don't feel under any pressure to do that.
You know, you're going to ask me a question still, I'll give you two answers.
Well, I was going to say, I'm surprised you didn't give me all three, go on.
I'm going
to
give you all three. I think we got to 71, Dave's right. There was a famous game just ahead about the Dutch FA changed the dates of the game to give Ajax more time to prepare. They played Feyenoord in the last but one game of the Eredivisie on the Wednesday before the final. And it was a soaking wet pitch. And Ajax players didn't want to get injured, and Feyenoord basically kept them up in the air and won. But it was a big thing to get to that final, to win the final. I spoke to Ruud Krol about it, and after Feyenoord won in 70, there's a guy, a journalist, famous Dutch journalist called Jaap de Groot, who works for the De Telegraaf, very famous newspaper in the Netherlands, who said, made a big thing about it doesn't matter whether it's Amsterdam or Rotterdam, it's the Netherlands. Ruud Krol didn't agree with that. And he said, you know, I mean, other people might think about in Amsterdam, nobody thought about that. So it was a big thing. It was a big thing. 71 was a big thing. 72 was probably the best final. And it, at the end of the 72 season, Ajax played three games at the De Kuip within 3 weeks of each other. The first one was the KNVB Cup final, where they won the KNVB Cup in Feyenoord's ground. The second one was the last but one game in the Eredivisie, where they played Feyenoord on Feyenoord's ground and beat them and won the Eredivisie title there. And finally, they played the final of the European Cup at the De Kuip, Feyenoord Stadium, and won the European Cup there. But 73, because you mentioned campaign, you know, 73 was probably the best campaign, in as much as, aside from CSKA Sofia, who came back the following year, they beat CSKA Sofia 3-0 at home, 3-1 away. Jerry Muren had been injured for a while. Sorry, Jerry Muren missed a penalty, which didn't seem very important when you win in 6-1. But 12 months later, they came back to haunt them. But aside from CSKA, they played the German champions, Bayern. They played the Spanish champions, Real. And in the final, they played the Italian champions, Serie A champions, Juve. And it was the game was in Belgrade, former capital of the Yugoslavia, and it was so hot that they played almost a walking pace. The final was terrible. Basically, it was Juve's first European final, and they were nervous as hell. and they never came out to play. They almost seemed satisfied by losing 1-0 to Rep's goal. So each of those three tournaments, those three campaigns have all got memorable things to it. So, you know, there's three answers for you, mate.
To be fair, like I say, it's your book, Gary, and you always give me more than one answer anyway. Now, the second question, fellas. Now, Gary, I'm going to ask you this one first because it's not fair on the other two. And with all your knowledge and wizardry of Dutch football, you should be able to answer this just like that. So my next question to all three of you is, I would like you to name me who you think is the single most influential person in this story of Gary's. So this rise of Ajax up to 1973, who is, in your opinion, the most influential or important individual in the story? You can go as way back as you want, and you can go right up to 1973. But obviously, I also need a reason. Gary, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to try and restrict you to just one person. Otherwise, you'll give me about 17. But ideally, who, in your opinion, and you must have had a lot of time to think about this, having written two books about Dutch football in this time period, but who to you is the single most influential figure in this story?
Well, the temptation is to say Jannie ten Veen, who used to play for Ajax and introduced Cruyff to Ajax. But I suppose the big three would be between Cruyff, Mikkels, and... You see, I'm covering the bases here.
Yeah, you can word it how you want. You can word it however you want, but there's still clearly more than one.
I think it'd have to be Mikkels, because without Mikkels, Cruyff probably wouldn't have been the player that he was. It might still be brilliant, but he probably wouldn't be the player that he was. Without Mikkels, Kovacs wouldn't have had the opportunity to build on what Mikkels had done. So I think I'd have to say Mikkels, mate.
Okay, Dave, for you, in your considered opinion and worldly wise opinion, who do you see as the most influential figure?
Well, the Magnificent Seven, I think, are I don't know. I've got a soft spot for Jack Reynolds, really, the kind of the instigator of all of that stuff from the start. It's just such a great story, you know, being sort of, well, not exactly expelled from this country, but, you know, a prophet not welcomed in his own home, having to go abroad and setting up what became, you know, one of the great European clubs, remains one of the great European clubs, and putting all those sort of foundations down of the way that they played the game, the idea of it going through the whole culture of the football club. So, I would go for him.
I see. This is why I like asking these. I was hoping you'd all come up with different answers. Stephen, over to you.
I'm going for the obvious. It's Cruyff. You know, he's at the centre of everything. He is the spider in the web. You know, he's the puppeteer. Yeah, without Mikkels, you know, I think the fact that Ajax continue and probably play better football after Mikkels goes, because, you know, Kovacs takes off the handbrake. Always fascinated by the concept of Kovacs. You know, when we did the Ajax magazine, you know, I wrote the article on Kovacs in that one, and, you know, there was no one else I wanted to write about for that. But like you say, you know, the stepping stones, you know, to get to Kovacs, and if you remove any of the stepping stones prior to that, then there's no Kovacs, there's no handbrake for him to take off. But within that, Cruyff is just pivotal to the whole spectrum of that, all the way up to his departure, you know, and the fact, you know, he comes back and helps instigate this new rise of them. You know, Cruyff is kind of, you know, he's the co-manager on the pitch. You know, he's absolutely everything. He is the spider at the centre of the web.
Like I say, we're already sort of well over the hour, and I'm sure we could do another hour on this. Now, just as interesting, Gary, as the story is, and the build-up and the context, and again, we're all human, so we do also like that element of jeopardy in any good story, in any good tale, in any team. And we've talked what seems like quite a while ago now about vulnerability of these great sides. So, you know, to begin with, you know, you have to finish this story, and clearly you don't finish it with sort of the final whistle in 1973. You take, you know, you go beyond and, you know, and let the readers know and discuss sort of what, you know, what came next. And again, was that, were you tempted to leave it on a high, or did to do the story justice, did it need that end, you know, the sort of not so sweet ending?
I think it did, because if there's something iconic about Dutch football, it's that, you know, when they have success, it's brilliant success, but it never lasts long. Going back to the national team didn't qualify for a World Cup till 1974, got to the final, lost to the host. 4 years later, got to the final, lost to the host, didn't qualify again for another dozen years or so. I don't know how many years, 14, 16 years or so. And Ajax there again, you know, they got to four finals in 5 years and then disappeared for a decade until Van Gaal came along. I think it is important to say that, you know, this isn't a trail of success that goes on for, like, Real Madrid, for example, who, you know, won it in the 50s and then they're reigning champions still, and, you know, and every chance of winning it again, anything past City in the semi-final. This is a tale of a club that's, you know, came from nowhere to the top of the tree in the shortest time imaginable, and then sort of fell away afterwards. And I think it is important to understand as why that happened, as it is that it did happen. For example, the tenure of Kovacs was very sort of laid back, and Cruyff took upon himself to be almost, as Stevie mentioned, like almost like a surrogate manager. So when the hard truth had to be told, he was the guy who told it. And that built up resentment among other players. So the thing that Kovacs gave them, the freedom to play, almost become their doom as well. And, Dutch players have, the size of an ego of Montana. Now, Stevie said about arrogance, and I interviewed a guy for the Beautiful Bridesmaid book called Jan Herman de Bruyne, a Dutch journalist. And he says there is nothing more arrogant than a Dutchman. And, you know, and so you can imagine these guys now who have won three European Cups. They all think they're brilliant. And yeah, they were. Let's face it, they bloody were. But they all had egos, massive egos. And when, you know, it came to the vote to who was going to be captain at the beginning of the following season, apparently a lot of players didn't want to vote for Cruyff because of the tensions there. And apparently Harry Hahn tells a story that a lot of the directors of the club were encouraging the younger players, and Hahn did this, to vote against Cruyff, vote for Kaiser, because the club wanted to put Cruyff in his place. This is typical of Dutch football. You know, going back to what Stevie said, the only team, the only club that could beat Ajax in the end were Ajax. And they sort of, it was almost a case of self-immolation. You know, they set themselves on fire because they flew too close to the sun. You know, he says, dropping a phrase in there from the other book. But they did, they destroyed themselves. And I think that's important that, you know, to the story is what made them great also became the thing that destroyed them.
Coming back again, Dave, to how, you know, you described it wonderfully about why this, you know, why this team is loved so much. And obviously there's the success, you know, there's one more in the Champions League era, so, sort of success for Ajax. But do you think that, you know, we talked about Bayern Munich and they go on to win three, but then Bayern Munich go on and do it. And Gary just mentioned there, Real Madrid go on and do it. Do you think the fact that Ajax have struggled to reach those dizzy heights again, the fact that it was, as you know, to quote a phrase from Gary, it burnt so brightly, but then it's never come back. Do you think that is also part of the allure of this side, that almost eternal hope that it can come back?
What Stephen was saying earlier about, you know, the Beatles analogy, that kind of, Ajax are more like a band than any other football team that there's ever been, I think. And there is that glorious three-album period. And then there's a load of dross. And then all of a sudden, you know, just as you think they're about to retire and never come back again, they make that one great album again in 1995, and then that's completely the finish. And there is something about that with Ajax. They are unusual in that way. I mean, I think, you know, I've written some music books, and the interesting parts of actually most sort of factual books is the struggle to get there and then the collapse afterwards. And the bit where they're successful is really boring, because success is the same for everybody, really. You know, they play a different way or whatever, but by and large, the success is a really dreary kind of period, because, you know, they have everything goes great, and frankly, that's not particularly interesting. The thing with Ajax is that their successful period is fascinating, because they did it in such a different way to everybody else, and the nature of the football that they played was different to, you know, other teams having a successful period. I don't know whether that answers the question, but there we are.
No, I love a good music analogy. Any thread that we can sew through a podcast absolutely makes my day. The three album analogies is actually really, really good. I was trying to think of bands who'd have three really good albums. I was just mentally going through some of them. In fact, I might hand that question over to you, actually, Stephen. If you were to sum this story up into a musical analogy, where would you put this Ajax side?
They are the Beatles, kind of circa, you know, Hard Day's Night to Let It Be. You know, you've got the buttoned up version of that Meekles offers from the mid 1960s. That's Brian Epstein. You know, they're all wearing suits. They're all well turned out. You know, everything's impeccable. And then there's Kovacs at the end. Yeah, everyone's got long hair and a beard, looking pretty, you know, stylishly dishevelled. But you know, it's the long and winding road. It's you know, it's Get Back. It's you know, it's all of the most beautiful tunes. You know, and then there's Paul McCartney at the top of his game. Apple Corps up on the roof, and that's where it finishes. You know, and had John survived, you know, beyond 1980, then the Beatles would have brought out one off really absolutely cracking album around about 95.
So, did any of this go through your head, Gary, when you were sort of subliminally writing this book? Was there any Beatles playing in the background or no?
No, I think it should have been.
Yeah, I think it should have been as well. Right, guys, I'm going to give you a little bit of thinking time. So I'm going to remember, you've got to come up with a tagline to sell this book. So that's going to be the next question that I'm going to ask you. But I'll give you a little bit of thinking time. I'll do a bit of fill-in. If anyone's got any news about family and friends, feel free to share it now while we give people time to chat. Or if you could do some clever pausing time, Dave, that would also be great. But ultimately, we tried this with Aidan's book, and it went quite well, actually. So you need to come up with, and I include you in this, Gary, as well, because it is your book, so you might want to come up with a really good one too. So you need to come up with a tagline that you would use to sell this book of Gary's. I would ask for a volunteer as to who wants to go first, but I'm not... Oh, brilliant,
I'll go,
Gary.
I'll go first.
Leading by example. Oh, Gary, yeah. Okay, Stephen, you go first.
I'll go first. Because we all, you know, as kids, we all called them Ajax, though, didn't we? So, you know, there's a bit of kind of like, you know, easily dissolves, you know, stuck on grease. How about Stronger Than Dirt? I'll have Stronger Than Dirt.
Love that. Brilliant. Well, we'll take that. That's for the people who grew up in the 70s and whose mums had one of them cardboard tubes that look like Pringles of Ajax, and you were the metal top that sprinkled into your sink. I'm right with you on that one. Gary, for you then, what's your tagline to sell your book?
Well, the title actually is, I'll tag the tagline on the end. The title is Dutch Masters. When Ajax is total football, conquered Europe. And the tagline is, and it was beautiful.
Oh, nice. Yep, love that. And for the last one then for you, Dave, you can have the fan. Now, if this is real good, I'm sure Gary will just put it on the front of his book. So I'm sure we can get him to put it on the front. How are you going to sell this book?
This has got the added value of people typing it in wrong. You'll come up on Amazon. Johan Cruyff in the Philosopher's Stone.
Oh. That's what happens when you go last. That's what happens.
I'm going to get in touch with Alcock and ask him. It's called his book in English. The English translation is Johan Cruyff, Always on the Attack. But I'm going to get in touch with him and ask him to change it to that nicely.
Oh, I tell you what, J.K. Rowling, honestly, yesterday's author, Gary, it's all about you now. Guys, like I say, it's been the most wonderful chat. Gary, when is the actual release date for your book?
22nd of May, it's officially out. It's doing really well on Amazon at the moment, though. It's been in the European League's top 10, top 20 for sort of the last three or four months, and I know that one or two in the hot new releases in that league as well. So it's been doing really well. So 22nd of May is official when it's stopped being posted out. So get the fight, guys. I mean, you know, anybody listening who's interested in beautiful football, this is the archetypal, this is the definitive, this is the book. It's the one book.
I've got, I mean, obviously we've been lucky enough to have a, you know, to get a copy, and it is just that good. It is absolutely fascinating. And I'm a strong believer that this is the sort of book that fans of football will love. I also think that Paul McCartney might owe us a few quid, and the whoever owns the back catalogue to the Beatles after this episode, I think they might see their sales go up on Amazon. Not that he needs it, but they might see their sales go up as well. So, Gary, one more book you say to come after this?
Yeah, it's I've finished the manuscript. It's back. It's with the publishers now. I've just been discussing the pictures, which is great. It's the best part of writing is getting the plate sorted out, and it'll be out in February 2024, and it's called O Jogo Bonito, Brazil's 1970 World Cup Samba Party. That'll be my final one. That's my sort of curtain call. Definitely.
I can't believe Gary Thacker is going off the book marriage market. There's going to be a lot of upset people up and down the country. However, we can start planning our taglines for that. Guys, like I say, it's been brilliant. They always are. I've forgotten how good the stag do's are. Stephen, thank you for joining us. And once again, like I say, we're racking up these stag do's between us.
I think we could release these as a box set. I mean, an anthology even, shall we say.
Oh, nice. You just, honestly, absolutely just full of talent.
I think we're gonna move the whole platform to Disney Plus in a year or two.
I'm sure Disney will buy the rights to these episodes, no problem. Dave, thank you ever so much. And thanks for the surprise as well about hosting and stuff. That was great, right at the beginning.
You're trying to prepare yourself, to be perfectly honest. So
I am really sorry. It was a massive miscalculation by me. I apologise.
Well, I think the listener won't have noticed. It was all seamless.
Well, they will do when the outtake goes out. Then they'll notice.
What, of me just looking blank and there being no speaking?
Yeah.
And then finally, Gary, thank you, obviously, for writing the book. It, you know, it's another absolute triumph. I would say long may you write books about things that you love and enjoy, but clearly you're about to run out.
Yeah, but yeah, thank you for being so kind, guys, about the book, and great to talk about, you know, like I say, my non-Chelsea favourite club of all time. Thanks, guys. Much appreciated.
No problem. All that's left to say is thank you for listening. Please join one of us, all of us, some of us, most of us again on the next edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.